From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on June 1st in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. President Donald Trump announced his intention to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Accord. And he said, rather famously that day, quote, "I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris." It was a decision that goes against the deal signed by nearly 200 other nations. And as the New York Times noted, it was an intentional and direct rebuke to heads of state, climate activists, and frankly, many members of the president's own staff. What does it really mean for all of us, and how are people responding here? Our guests are going to help us understand this decision and the path forward in several contexts. And they include Lawrence Torricello. He is an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Kevin Schulte is the CEO of Sun Common New York, which is what? Tell us about that.
We are Western New York's largest solar installer.
All right. It's great to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We just saw, Kevin, President Trump cutting the ribbon and celebrating at the opening of one of the first new coal mines in a while. And I wonder how someone in the solar industry was reacting to that visual.
Frankly, it's a sad future for us that would be celebratory. From a couple of perspectives, I don't think the opening of a new coal mine is strong for our economy, creating just some 50 to 70 new jobs. And I think it's really sad for our planet. Ultimately, burning coal is the worst carbon emitter of all the fossil fuels and the power of the 20th century and something we should be moving on from.
You employ how many at Sun Common?
In New York, we are about 42 people right now, full-time, and then we have a number of anywhere from 20 to 50 temporary laborers working for us at any time.
So you're roughly the same amount of jobs as that coal operation that the president was celebrating, but you're not a national headline.
No, I'd love to be.
yes.
And frankly, we've doubled in the last 12 months in our size, and we'll double again in the next 12 months with our current pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to employment, just some of the NPR numbers, which are somewhere in my notes here, it's sort of a lot to a little, but I've got the actual numbers, according to NPR, here we go, more than 260,000 jobs in the U.S. solar industry now. That's up 82% from just 3 years ago. There's more than 100,000 in wind. That's up 100%. And in all, more than 800,000 Americans have jobs in the renewable energy industry. That comes from NPR and the Boston Globe. And NPR also says that 50,000 roughly in coal is it. And that's been declining despite the headlines around this. So the trends seem clear. Does it seem like, even just on the economy alone, a mistake to throw the spotlight on coal?
Yes, we're cheaper. The reality of coal is it is an expensive way, even with no environmental controls as we have in some of our states in the U.S., it is an expensive way to get fuel. We have to mine the coal from the earth. We have to transport it to the coal mine. We then have to burn it. Then we have to deal with the waste. So when you add up all of those costs, it is just more expensive than when you look at technologies like wind and solar now that sit here and operate with no fuel costs. The sun shines and the wind blows. Let's grab that.
Let me ask Professor Torricello to kind of offer his perspective. First, simply on the president's announcement in Pittsburgh alone. It was pretty well known that he was likely going to pull the United States out of Paris. Wasn't a surprise, but it happened. Let's just take that on its own. What's your reaction to the decision?
Yep. My first reaction, and it's a strange one, given how much I care about this issue, is a sense of relief. I would have been legitimately disturbed had he decided to stay in this agreement, because by pulling out of the agreement, he gives a clear signal that can't be mistaken, that he cares not a bit about this issue, which we already knew already. I didn't have to tolerate listening to any pundits talking about whether he was going to change. Has he seen the light? Has Rex Tillerson or his son-in-law Jared somehow converted him to the renewable revolution? I mean, none of that nonsense. I think it's long overdue that we all take a hard look at where we are on this issue, who is leading us on this issue, and what we have to do responsibly as individual citizens without national leadership on this issue.
That is such an interesting response, because what I think I'm hearing you say is, had we stayed in Paris, which is non-binding, so we could have stayed in and not really changed anything, that there would have been all this discussion about, you know, sort of this patina of change that wouldn't have been an actual change. But now you view this decision publicly announced as a rallying cry?
I think it unmistakably is a rallying cry. And I think we've seen the response to it in all sorts of different ways at different levels, at the subnational level, at the level of citizens, international level. Everyone has basically become more united on this issue, and Trump has made himself a little less relevant on the issue, which is how it should be. And it's how we should think about it. And this is what we should focus on moving forward, is that we don't have him on board as a leader. We have to pick up the slack. So, I mean, make no mistake, I'm of two minds about this. You know, I recognize that there's the Paris Accord, as weak and imperfect as it is still an important statement. And I'd like to talk about that. I think it's best to look at it as a moral statement or a moral agreement. And that's really where its strength is. But at the same time, I would have been really disturbed had this person, who clearly isn't going to do anything on this issue, gone through the motions, another con, if you will, that, yeah, I can't be predicted. I mean, maybe you just never know what I'm going to do. Maybe I'll turn around. Maybe I won't. No, I think it's important we just keep our eye on the ball, because this is an important issue.
Listeners, if you want to join the program as we talk about post-Paris Accord and this path forward here, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Are you worried about abdication of moral leadership around the world with this decision?
That is a serious worry. I understand that that's something we should be concerned about. I don't think it's as serious as a worry as some other people perhaps do. And the reason is because I believe what we've heard here already about the opportunities for renewables, the economic opportunities moving forward, how coal and fossil fuels really are losing prospects moving forward. And I do think the other nations, and they have their own problems on this issue too, to be fair, but I do think other nations aren't infected with the sort of climate denialism that the U.S. is infected with. I think China knows it's a real issue. So they know that they have to do this for their own good, in their own self-interest, and the rest of the world does too. I believe that climate change is actually occurring, and I believe that there's a brighter economic future in renewables. And those two facts are going to dictate the rest of the world. And I don't think that we have to assume the rest of the world is suffering the same political problems that we clearly are suffering from in the U.S.
And let me follow up. You mentioned as weak and imperfect as the Paris Accord was. Yeah. I want to pull back there, because I had a really rational, calm discussion at the place for the most rational, calm discussions, which is, of course, Twitter, about this, you know, after the president's decision. And one of the things that distressed me was seeing, some of the opprobrium, often coming from the political left, but not exclusively, of people saying, well, you know, we just wrecked the planet. Now we're doomed. And that sort of ignored the fact that Paris is non-binding, that you can be in it and sort of, you know, kind of play by your own rules, and that even if we kind of catered to the word in the accord, you had Paul Hansen and many other some very distinguished scientists saying it's not enough anyway. And so my concern was, even if we adhered to Paris and it was binding, it might not be enough. And the fact that it's non-binding, our country is actually going to follow through. What you're saying is China kind of gets it and they're going to get on board. Are you concerned about that, though, Professor, that this may be a moral agreement, but it doesn't have teeth, and it may get people thinking, well, pat ourselves on the back, we signed a non-binding agreement, and we're just going to kind of keep burning fossil fuels into the foreseeable future?
So I think that's sort of the kind of cognitive dissonance that's in play when people take an agreement like this and they exaggerate the benefit that it actually has. Is a problem, because it lulls us into a dangerous place where we could, give up our own responsibility and think that, well, the nations of the world, they seem to be coming together and doing something. But when the fact is that, as you point out, it's not binding. It requires nothing. It's all aspirational. And if we're going to address this problem, it's not going to be because of that agreement. It's going to be because of the nations understanding that they have an overlapping set of good, strong, self-interested reasons to actually address climate change before it's too late. So, I mean, did I answer your question?
I think so. Yeah, okay. I mean, I think so. And you're sort of strangely more optimistic than I expected you to be. So it's a good surprise.
More so than I expected I would be.
Yeah. Let me grab our first phone call. It's Pat in Rochester. Go ahead, Pat.
Hi, Evan. Glad to be on. So the state passed a law allowing for a 15-year tax exemption for solar, for wind, and for bio energy alternatives for both residences and businesses. And it gave an opt-out for local government, villages and towns to opt out of it. And the only municipality that I'm aware of in Monroe County just a couple of months ago that did opt out of it, so it does not have this tax exemption now, is the town of Parenton. And I was just wondering what your guests think of that kind of reaction from a local government.
Pat, thanks for the phone call. I think Mr. Schulte is probably well positioned. Kevin?
Yeah, so we're dealing with this actually all over Western New York. There are actually quite a few municipalities who have opted out. None of them really in total, very rarely. So there are three taxing jurisdictions in any for any project: the town or city, the county, and the school district. And each one of them has the option to stay in the exemption or leave. In most cases, if they do leave, reasonable assessments are placed on projects so that they continue to show economic benefit to the people of Western New York, and we're sort of not overburdening them with a property tax problem. There are some places where, you know, too much property tax is being put on potential solar and wind projects, and those do slow projects down. But with good, reasonable folks in most of our legislatures, we have gotten around that issue or through it. And frankly, one of the ways to do that is with local solar and wind production. We're actually negotiating deals with school districts and towns and county governments to actually bring them the power in lieu of some hefty property tax assessment at a significant discount over what they would be paying to their local utility.
Okay, back to your phone calls. Daryl in Naples. Oh, Daryl, we lost you. Come on back, Daryl. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me grab a couple of emails. Tim wants to know, do any of your panelists understand what the Paris Agreement costs us as a nation? I've had it explained to me that it costs us much more money than any other nation. In addition, most of our industries already meet or exceed the standards laid out in the agreement. So let's listen to what President Trump had to say about pulling out and some of the reasoning there, and then we'll get our panelists to weigh in on some of the costs there.
The Paris Climate Accord is simply the latest example of Washington entering into an agreement that disadvantages the United States to the exclusive benefit of other countries, leaving American workers, who I love, and taxpayers to absorb the cost in terms of lost jobs, lower wages, shuttered factories, and vastly diminished economic production. Thus, as of today, the United States will cease all implementation of the non-binding Paris Accord and the draconian financial and economic burdens the agreement imposes on our country.
All right, that's President Trump talking about that. And Tim wants to know about some of the costs. Professor?
I'd like to know. I think it's a mystery to me what he's talking about there. One thing that should be stated up front is that the United States has a history of undermining negotiations to get good deals for the United States. That's one of the reasons this is such a weak accord to begin with. It's because the United States is infected with lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry and the politicians who are doing their bidding. So it was already engineered to be a deal that is giving the advantage to nations like the United States that lead the world in carbon output and have historically benefited from that, while really putting other nations in a very disadvantaged point of view. Now, the only real costs, and this is a shared burden, come with the UN climate, the Green Fund, where nations like the United States are going to help offset, or ought to, and they should morally do so, offset the costs of switching away from fossil fuels to renewables in the development when it comes to nations like India and other developing nations. Now, I think there's a $500 billion goal for that fund. The United States has committed $4 billion to it, and we've only given $1 billion so far. And long before he pulled out, of course, Trump signaled that that was coming to an end. So, and given all the upsides economically, the fact that China is, you know, gangbusters on solar panels, for instance, I'm really at a loss to explain what in the world he's talking about, other than just making up things as usual.
Okay, Kevin?
It's nonsensical rhetoric. What the president is talking about, closing factories and all of these things, your own economic statistics on job creation in wind and solar obviously trump that. So I'm not, again, you know, to Larry's point, I'm not really sure what he's talking about. The costs to this country, right, we committed something on the order of $100 billion over time to Paris in investment dollars. That's not to say that we put the money in and don't get it back. I mean, wind and solar projects and this type of investment that we're asking for returns standard investor returns, 8, 10% return on your money. So you're going to get the money back that you invest. What they're asking us to do is back less fortunate countries than us in their own renewable energy investment so that we, and then the money comes back to you. It's not put a dollar out and lose. Ultimately, our industries are opening factory doors, and that type of investment, you know, spurred by things of the last 8 to 15 years of good government policies driving renewable energy growth in this country. So I just don't understand the concept of tying the clean energy explosion, a $1 trillion economic opportunity as we go into battery storage, you know, upgraded solar panels and the like. Why we're not looking at that as an opportunity, and we're looking at, you know, closed coal mines of the past because those are expensive and outdated technologies.
All right, Frank in Rochester wants to talk about the ethics involved in climate change. Go ahead, Frank.
Yes, Evan. Thanks for doing this program. This is for Dr. Turcello. You stated in your very powerful essay, "Yes, I am a climate alarmist. Global warming is a crime against humanity." That's April 29th in The Guardian. And you said, "The climate policies of the Trump administration, backed by many Republican leaders, are rooted in culpable ignorance and transparent corruption, and they place all of us at risk on a scale that previous crimes against humanity never have." Can you talk about how philosophers see the ethical problems involved in climate change?
Well, thanks, Frank, for that question, and thank you for the kind words about my piece. Before the show began, we were talking while we were waiting about how climate change has been described by at least one philosopher, Stephen Gardner, who works on this issue quite a bit, as the perfect moral storm. It's a topic that, well, let me put it this way. Every living being on the planet will eventually be affected by climate change. That's an awful lot of morally relevant beings, human beings, animals. It's an issue that brings into play intergenerational ethics. The world that we're preparing for the youngest children on the planet right now is going to be a much more hostile world in terms of environmental conditions than the world that many of us had the luxury of growing up in. And that's not even to bring into play future generations and what we're leaving to them. And I yet to speak about the power differential between the global north and the global south, and how those who are least responsible for this problem are the very people who are on the front lines right now and suffering the greatest impacts. The target that the Paris Agreement, which, as I said before, I think we should just think of as an ethical pact, was 2C, but the aspiration to the aspiration of 2C was 1.5, and that's really a more important target for people in the global south. It's important for us to remember that climate vulnerability is not monolithic across the planet, and we could be very comfortable here in Rochester talking about impacts that are coming down the road and some impacts that we're starting to experience locally. But on the other side of the planet, there are people who are beginning to make plans for relocation because their native lands will be underwater soon. And that sort of displacement is a prelude to genocide historically. And if any nation, as I wrote in my piece, were doing this on purpose, the global community would rightfully be arguing about whether or not this was a form of cultural genocide that was occurring. And again, that's a prelude to actual genocide. And we know that there's going to be a very serious influx into the north from people who are seeking refuge from climate disasters moving forward. So all of this, again, brings on the perfect moral storm.
Let me get a call on the more on the question on solar and wind installations and different projects that are out there. This is in Clifton Springs. It's Mary. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm in agreement with your previous caller. I did go to the Parliament of World Religions in Salt Lake City and work with the Indigenous grandmothers, and they talked about everything your guest is talking about. My question is, I'm trying to do my part and put up a solar roof system on my house. I started talks and getting all my things done, pre-work done back in February. I'm trying to get a permit from the town of Manchester in Ontario County to get this work done, and there's a moratorium on all wind and solar projects. They originally said 6 months. I went to the town board meeting last night, and it's indefinite at this time. My question is, does anyone else know, do any other towns around here also have these moratoriums, and how best to light a fire under my town board to get this resolved so I can get my system up?
Mary, thanks for the phone call. Kevin Schulte, you want to address it? He's the CEO of SunCommon New York.
So I think that the best thing to do in communication with your town is to make sure that they're creating a bifurcating line between residential solar on your rooftop or in your backyard and large commercial solar. What has happened, and I do understand some cautiousness amongst town and county legislatures and officials, is a lot of solar is coming very quickly and a lot of wind is coming very quickly. And those folks are cautious in creating land use plans that put solar and wind in the appropriate place within your community. So be mindful of the fact that they have a job to do, and that is to look out for the long-term land use in your community. But let's create a dialogue with them that allows them to take residential rooftop solar and backyard solar for your home out of that moratorium, and so you can move forward. There's really no reason to tie the two together. If we're putting rooftop panels at your home or in your backyard, there is both building code in New York State and nationally that create guidelines that most towns and counties and have adopted. So, and we'd be happy to help you with the issue. Just give us a call.
Thank you for the phone call, Mary. I want to address an email from a listener named Richard, who I think has expressed some skepticism about climate change in the past. And he says, Evan, why is Germany going back to coal power? Richard, they're not, but they're burning more coal right now than they did last year and more than the year before. And I want to, first of all, plead Dunning-Kruger here. I don't want to be the expert on Germany. I'm not. I know what I read, and I'm often wrong. But I'm trying to understand it because Germany is often invoked as a real leader when it comes to moving towards renewables, solar in particular. So, Richard, I'm going to try to address that, and then I'll let our guests also weigh in here. Germany is not going back to coal power. Germany is burning more coal this year, to some dismay, not nearly as much as they did in decades past. and they burned more carbon last year. And the reason is this. First of all, in Germany, on any given day there in recent years, there have been days where 90% of the grid has been essentially renewable. It's roughly a third to 40%, which is a big, big gain. And we're seeing Germany really pushing solar in particular and wind as well. They have something called the Energiewende. I don't know how to pronounce the German pronunciation, but it's a plan to reduce carbon output by 2020, a significant amount, and it's also a plan to spread the use of renewables. What they're running into is Europe's got to figure out sort of how kind of a bigger grid, a better grid. And sometimes there's an energy glut there. And this is from the MIT Technology Review. They said, for Germany, helpful would be a Europe-wide supergrid that would enable renewable power to be easily transported across borders, reducing the need for reliable, always-on fossil fuel plants to supplement intermittent electricity from solar and wind. And they talked about efforts to build that grid. They're expensive, but that kind of thing would certainly matter. The article here kind of just lays it out that the short answer is this, Richard. You can't change an energy system overnight perfectly, and there's going to be hiccups, but Germany continues to lead the way, and they're not going back to coal. They're sort of figuring out how to deal with gaps, sometimes gluts, and sometimes a Europe-wide grid need, but they're still moving forward on it. So Germany's not pulling back saying, well, that solar thing was nice, we're going back to coal. Kevin, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. The grid is a very complicated thing. And, you know, we hear terms like smart grid and all of these things that are part of our energy future and a reason for development and a reason for economic opportunity. And for those things, we will approach them as we go forward. When you look at a place like Germany, what they're doing is they're using old fossil burning plants, coal plants, in times of peak need. The same way that you're discussing, and the same way that we do here in New York. In Oswego, there's a coal power plant right in the middle of town, and it gets turned on a couple times a month when the energy use in New York requires it, right? When we turn on enough lights and enough air conditioners that we have to do it. So that's a global problem. In the United States, we have a little bit more of a super grid as we connect a number of regional independent system operators across the country, and they're interconnected to each other. But as we talk about transmission planning and infrastructure building as part of the president's agenda, this is a huge part of our future. You know, what do we know? Do we have a sense as to why it costs so much more for a kilowatt hour of electron produced by the same source in New York City as it does in Rochester, New York, where it costs almost 2 to 3 times as much? The reason? It's much more constrained. The lines are much smaller to get down into New York City, and it's 9 million people. So we have these problems right here at home, and the way to solve them is through, as Evan described, sort of super grid upgrades as we go forward. And then secondarily with reduction in consumption on the other side, right? So we all need to do our bit on energy efficiency, local solar production, et cetera, to reduce what's needed to come downstream from the main transmission grid, which is where that sort of influx of fossil burned energy would come from.
Now, let me pivot that in an ethics or moral way to Professor Torcello with this. You know, one thing that's come up often is this idea that in 1890, there was no gas stations, and 30 or 40 years later, there were gas stations on every corner, that there was an energy system change society-wide. We did it because we wanted to, felt we probably needed to, and could. The difference is you didn't have a horse and buggy industry that was a lobbying juggernaut, that was funding huge campaigns. Maybe, I don't think so. I'm willing to be corrected on that. And so now, my concern is this. We know we need to change energy systems if we want to preserve, I mean, this planet will be here. I don't know if humans will be here. And if we want to preserve humankind on this planet, we need to make a change. We have been able to do it with the force of will, with the force of innovation. I mean, humans are pretty good at that when they decide to do it. Mm-hmm. But now we've got lobbying, it's really, really hard, spreads of misinformation, and we have human lifetimes that aren't enough of a time scale to see some of the dramatic change, though we're certainly starting to see it, that would make it so incontrovertible that there would be no debate anymore. There would be no way to try to sort of ascribe blame to other sources. And so the human lifetime is short enough that you can be comfortable and you can burn a lot of coal and feel pretty good and die and leave it off to others. I don't know, with all of those factors, that we're going to make the systems change in the same way we did from 1890 to 1930. I'm less sanguine. How do you feel about that?
Yeah. I mean, so you're determined to make me more pessimistic.
No. I'm just trying to be realistic.
Right. No, that's absolutely the heart of this tough problem, all of these factors. And, you know, it's not necessarily the most satisfying answer, but I think that we are going to, if we're going to solve this problem, and you're right to point out that the planet will be here, and the reason this is an ethical issue is because of the living organisms on the planet that are morally relevant, of course, human beings and humanity included in that. I think we begin to address climate change seriously when we begin to think about ethics seriously. Everything that's required to meet this problem is also required of us ethically, to act in ways that aren't only in our self-interest, but are in the interests of other morally relevant beings who we may never meet, who may live on the other side of the world, who may be in a weaker, more vulnerable position than we are. Acting morally isn't something that's contingent upon benefiting from that action. And so this is why ethics is so important to this problem in a way that maybe it wasn't 100 years ago in other transitions. To solve climate change, we're required to make we're required to make ethical choices. We're required to think and change the way we think, actually, in terms of morality. We're required to start thinking about how when we needlessly expand our own carbon footprint, that this has ethical ramifications that are in some sense not directly noticeable in the immediate moment to us, but nevertheless are going to have real impacts, life and death impacts, on other people on the planet. That's how we have to start thinking. I don't know how optimistic I am. I'm hopeful that we're capable of making ethical changes. I hope we do it soon enough.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to the way organisms live, they're pretty good at avoiding things that kill them and adapting to avoid those things that kill them, unless you can't really see that it's killing you. That's what's scary to me about this, is our time frames may not be long enough to really get our heads around it.
So let me just add to that along those lines. We evolved as a species to think about morality in relation to the community around us. And we evolved our ancestors didn't see the number of people I saw driving to the studio today in many cases. And so the population of the planet and the experiences that we have are things that we haven't evolved to necessarily deal with. And I'm not saying that ethics depends upon our human nature necessarily, or that we could derive ethics from evolution, but we do have limitations in terms of how intuitively we grasp the problems. And climate change, unfortunately, is one of those problems that are it's very difficult for us to grasp, because as morally important and ethically weighty as it is, it's a very abstract issue that you have to think about.
So, well, when we come back from our only break, we'll hit Scott's question. Scott emails to say, what can people do in their day-to-day lives to help the environment and bring the spirit of the Paris Agreement forward locally? It's a good question. We'll see what our guests have to say about that. Lawrence Torricello is an associate professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. Kevin Schulte is the CEO of Sun Common New York. And we'll get more of your phone calls as well after this break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, first hour, we talk to the writer Chidike Okeem. He's a black conservative, and he says there's a misunderstanding in the United States about what conservatism means in the African-American community, why it's valuable, but why it's often co-opted by the conservative movement. We'll talk about it. Then second hour, Rochester mayoral candidate Lori Thomas joins us for her second interview. Talk to you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Scott wanted to know what people can do in their day-to-day lives to help the environment and bring the spirit of the Paris Agreement forward locally. And something Kevin Schulte said during the break kind of brings to mind all the little things that we're doing in our lives, some of which are kind of naturally moving in a direction away from fossil fuels, yes?
Yeah. I mean, everything we do is electrifying. Larry and I were talking about buying a new, weed whacker for our yard. And you go out and you buy electric. You buy a battery-operated weed whacker. They're just as powerful. They're easier
to use. You have one, Larry?
Oh, yeah. And it's one of the best purchases I've ever made. I don't want to turn this into a computer or a commercial, but...
That's all right.
I mean, this is the first...
I have no stock in
this is the first season I haven't had to, throw my back out, trying to start the thing, swearing, becoming frustrated. I just press the lever and it starts fresh.
What's it called?
Every single time. It's Ego is the company, but I know Ryobi has a bunch of them too.
Everybody makes
it. So it's just, I highly recommend it. You'll love it. I guarantee it.
See? So there's one little thing. Yeah, but we're moving in that direction is what Kevin is saying.
Yeah. You know, I drive a plug-in electric car. You know, I have solar panels on my roof. These things save me money. You know, yes, I work for a solar company, but they save me money. I go 25 miles before I have to go to a gas station. I get that power from the solar panels on my roof and the solar panels at my office. This is an economic time where everything is becoming electrified, from our transport industry, you know, home products, everything we're doing, you know, far and far fewer options for gas dryers, gas hot water heaters as you go to the store. Those things, it's a better cost, it's a better value to go electric. And we are going to continue to electrify our grid with carbon-free sources. They are the fastest growing, wind and solar are the fastest growing sources of new energy on our grid year in and year out for the last 6 to 8 years. So that's the direction it's headed. So to your point before the break, I'm dramatically optimistic that the will of the people, especially people like Western New Yorkers who have such an independent and entrepreneurial spirit, are going to drive their own impact on the climate themselves, you know, and do these things as they can do them right at home.
Well, and one of the things you can do, Scott, check out the New York Times piece today. How much do you know about solving global warming? I'm not going to do the whole quiz, but it's based on Paul Hawkins. He's a green entrepreneur, and his new book is called Drawdown. It analyzes 100 potential solutions, ranking them 1 to 100 based on the amount of greenhouse gases they would cut. And I got some things wrong here, but I'm sure our guests will get these right. So how we eat. What do you think would reduce greenhouse gas emissions more? If half the world switched to a plant-rich diet, or if clean cook stoves, which reduce emissions of carbon dioxide, were adopted on a large scale in the developing world? So eat more plants or clean up the stoves.
Clean cook stoves.
Probably, but I'm going to go with you should eat more plants for other ethical reasons as well.
No, so. But he's right. That's the actual answer. Drawdown ranks plant-based diets as the number 4 climate change solution overall. So globally, food production and the amount of meat in particular produces the same amount of greenhouse gas as its power plants. So doing a better job on what we eat is really high on the list. Which would cut more greenhouse gases? If everyone threw out half as much food, or about half of all biodegradable food was composted. So waste less food or compost more often?
I'm going to say waste less.
I would guess compost.
Yeah, it's waste less food. See, I got all these wrong too. In the United States, 40% of all food is wasted. It's amazing. And according to the National Resources Defense Council, cutting down on waste to begin with is far more effective than composting what's wasted. Although, all good, by the way. Mm-hmm. Composting is really, really good. And then it kind of just goes on. So to our listener, Scott, check out this quiz. I learned a lot from this. You know, it has questions on what's more important, having cleaner and better flying options or building more trains, you know, bus riding, switching to electric or hitching rides and ride sharing, that kind of thing, changing your roof or getting new light bulbs, wind versus solar. You want to weigh in on that one, Kevin? What holds more promise, building wind farms or solar farms?
I think they fulfill different needs, so I would not answer that.
The answer is essentially both. That they are both very, very important to providing savings and energy relief in the future. Wind might actually offer even more effective remuneration of our power grids than solar in the long run, but both very, very important. And finally, what's the number one ranked solution for fighting climate change? The answer they have is managing refrigerants. It turns out that changing how we use and dispose of refrigerants, the chemicals used in refrigerators and air conditioners, has the potential to reduce greenhouse gases more than any of the other 99 strategies in the book. So they're all important.
Can I relate that last point back to eating in an ethical way as well?
Yeah.
Because I mean that, I mean if you're eating, you know, what you need, storing things for less long term, this all comes together. All of those things should be, by the way, considered ethical behaviors, and that's exactly what we're not used to thinking of those things as. With the exception, possibly, I mean, there's a lot of ethical vegetarianism, vegetarians and vegans out there, but those other things we don't normally think of as ethical behavior choices. But that's what we have to do in the future: start thinking of all these things as ethical choices.
And solar and wind are very high on the list, by the way. Both of them are very, very high because we're talking about reducing carbon, and that's a big way to do it. Carlo in Union Springs next on the phones. Go ahead, Carlo.
Thanks, Evan. I appreciate it. 2 days in a row. The caller who called in and said somehow Germany's gone back to coal, I guess he was going to deflate the whole conversation. A Fortune magazine a few months back had two very important articles, one about Germany, and yes, they've increased their coal because they need to finance their clean energy plan. They have a plan. I mean, the Germans, for Christ's sake, they got a plan. The other thing is, there was another article about the wind, the windmills that are being built along the East Coast, mainly private developers, huge investment. Block Island, which is a large island, has a few towns, a few airports on it. I spent some summers there. That entire island is going to be powered by these windmills. Apparently, the East Coast of this country has the strongest consistent winds, some of the strongest and most consistent winds in the country, in the world. Anyway, so that's a good thing, but all of this adds up to, I would say, investment. And I'm sorry, this our country, somewhere in the 80s or 90s, we got very complacent, and the oil industry made lackeys out of a lot of congressmen. I'm sorry, lackeys is the kindest word I can use, but we don't really invest beyond the tip of our nose. We do a little bit. There's some private, but the problem is the government's not pushing it. And if you look at after World War II, the investment we made, for example, in the interstate highway system created a huge amount of work. And they invested, and we saw the results. So I will take your response off the phone, but I think basically our government's not looking beyond the next quarter in general.
Carla, thank you for the phone call. Kevin Schulte first, what do you think?
Well, a popular political lightning rod in the solar business is Solyndra, right? 2009 stimulus money put into new technology in California, and it failed. As an investment of the U.S. government, it failed. At the same time, the Chinese government put $50 billion into three or four mega solar factories, and they became the preeminent manufacturer of solar technology on the globe by doing it. So I think the caller's point is extremely accurate. Our government has an extreme opportunity to invest in clean energy, storage, and clean transportation right now to get, first of all, to drive our economy into the future. As has been stated in places way smarter than me, a $1 trillion opportunity as we go into the future. And that is the opportunity of our government. And some people might say, it's not our government's job to sort of dictate social outcomes. Well, this is not a social outcome. This is our future. It's the future of our planet. Our planet is dying. The Earth's climate is baking. This is a reality agreed by scientists. So why wouldn't? What is the political impetus that it's going to take to actually get our government to make real investments in our future?
Well, sometimes we talk about government like it's some sort of like evil lurking outside entity when the government is supposed to be us and it's supposed mm-hmm. to be to serve us. We're supposed to be the bosses of it. So, Larry, you want to weigh in on that as well?
Yeah, thanks. I agree with both of those points. And really thanks, Evan, for saying that about government is us. I mean, that's so important. Whenever you hear a politician bashing government, don't trust that because that's like me becoming a philosophy professor and just trashing philosophy and just it makes no sense. This is something that the person has presumably dedicated their career to because they believe in it. So you have to wonder, why is it that they don't want you to think of government as something that is working for you and you're invested in? And also, government does choose outcomes. I mean, we've been choosing fossil fuel outcomes for many years now, again, which is why the agreement, the Paris Agreement, was so weak to begin with, because we've undermined it at every turn. And this is why I was so glad to see that Trump isn't staying in it, not because I think it's not an important agreement, even though it's weak in many ways, but because it would have been smarter for him to stay in it if he was interested in continuing the effort to undermine this agreement. Rex Tillerson wanted him to stay in it, and I'm not going to be one of those people who think Rex Tillerson somehow has the environment, first and foremost in mind when he wants to stay in the Paris Agreement. So it's a bad strategy. It tells me that Trump really isn't thinking this through and just playing to his base, keeping a campaign promise. And there's a little bit of hope there that he isn't thinking through in a strategic way how to really continue to work for fossil fuel interests in the way that we've been doing for the last 20, 30 years.
All right, Sandra in Brighton next on the phones. Go ahead, Sandra.
Hi. I wonder what you think about President Trump getting from Pope Francis, Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment. I was hoping that maybe President Trump might actually look at it, but it seems to be a good ethical basis, even if it is written by a Catholic Pope who happens to be a scientist, to help people come down to the ethical, a good ethical basis for doing this.
But Sandra, can I ask you a question?
Yes.
And I don't mean to be cynical, but did you really think that Trump was going to read?
No.
The encyclical?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I mean, I was hoping, but
I mean, I'm hoping to find a diamond the size of a refrigerator in my backyard. You know.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's probably
but,
a lot of things.
If he doesn't look at it, other people can. And pretty soon, maybe because we're having all these tornadoes and rain and weather that are going to be affecting our crops, I'm wondering down the line, are we going to really be having food problems in that you know, that in hitting us in the breadbasket?
Yeah, it's a good question. And Sandra, and maybe Professor Torchello, that would be the kind of thing that would spur more change sort of universally in this country, food issues and those kind of, I don't know, perhaps?
I mean, so insofar as people are feeling the crunch of the effects of climate change, I think that's, on one hand, unfortunate, but also one of the necessary components driving the American public's growing, you know, concern about climate change. We had a very mild, you know, February, and we were all out in our shorts enjoying the weather, but that's going to affect food prices in the fall. And the problem is, the more removed we are from the cause and the effect, the harder it is for us to make that connection. I would like to say something about Pope Francis. I wrote a piece in The Conversation I'm going to plug now called The Pope is Philosopher that you can Google my name and that title and you might find it. One of the things I love about the encyclical is that even though this is the Pope, he's writing in a way that should really be a model for our public discourse. He's writing in a way that reaches out not just to fellow Catholics, but to people of all faiths and no faith at all. And he's relying on science to make his point. And he's making arguments that if you don't agree with, you can at least understand. And that's something that seems to be missing from public discourse. And it's important to see a figure like Pope Francis doing something like that. So just to put that out there.
All right, a couple more listener questions on solar. First of all, Bob writes to the program and he adds, part of the reason Germany has been forced to use more coal is the rapid phasing out of its nuclear power infrastructure, to some extent as a response to the Fukushima disaster. France as well, by the way. You can argue the nuclear issue both ways. This comes from Dylan. Dylan says, I feel very lucky to have learned about and reside in the area that Sun Common operates. Bring on the panels and the solar farms and the community solar. Solar is now and the future. And a question from Ted in Rochester, who wants to know, is there a solution for renters or for people living in the city who are interested in solar and don't have a lot of sunlight?
Yes. So all throughout the region right now, we are building community solar farms where we are installing up to 7,000 or 8,000 modules at a time that are being distributed to 300 to 500 residential customers, whether they rent, whether they own. This is a statewide opportunity. And I think one of the things that Larry and I talked about going forward is we're going to bring this opportunity also to the low income here in Rochester under a grant that we're working on with the Department of Energy in the next 12 to 18 months as well, so that the community solar opportunity here in New York becomes a right of all rather than a privilege for those better off.
Yeah, Michael in Penfield wrote in to say he wanted to know, can he get a subsidy to buy solar panels?
Every kilowatt hour of electricity in this country is subsidized. So if you go to the gas pump and get some gas, you're getting a subsidy.
But the short answer he's asking for is a discount or a rebate right now.
Yes. Yes, both the state of New York and the federal government are offering incentives because solar is moving forward and the right thing to do.
And he wanted to know how much electrical usage is provided by solar and wind.
Right now, 6% of the country.
It's a big room for growth.
A lot of growth.
Kevin, thank you for being here. CEO of SunCommon New York. Online where?
SunCommon.com.
SunCommon.com. And Lawrence Torricello, Associate Professor in the Department of Philosophy at RIT. And one of the rare occasions where he's more sanguine than I am about certain things. But I appreciate it. And, you know, I mean, here's hoping that in so many ways that there is kind of a moment of at least introspection. I think Larry made a very, very interesting point this hour that I had not yet heard, which is that had we stayed in the Paris Agreement, there could have been a lot of obfuscation and a lot of confusion. And now there's a lot more clarity. And I think there's incredible value there. So thank you for coming in here and sharing your thoughts on it.
Thanks for having me.
Always great to have you, and always great to have you listening. Our thanks to Rob Braden engineering the broadcast today, Megan Mack producing. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon. A lot of sunshine. If there's solar on your roof, even better day for you. And we'll talk to you I'm not an investor, by the way. I'm just in the market. Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.